Good to have you with us. We're going to do a fill only today. Since I gave the panel the day off, and so they are off in their imaginary houses, having their imaginary, you know, alone time or something.
A long, long time.
So, welcome to our podcast, our show, our presentation, our audio presentation. And like I said, this also gives me a break from having to go through the, you know, go through the angst and the horror and the terror of creating a multi-voice show every day, Monday through Friday. So, and, you know, whatever approaching and advancing mental illness attends that, because that's pretty weird. It's weird, but it's what I do. And I'll be a son of a gun. I'm making a living doing it. Now, first of all, I'd just like to say to you, I'm saying it to Fred Willard, but I want you to be impressed by it. I want to thank Fred Willard for a very nice shout-out he gave me on Twitter today, calling me, quote, the best ever, which is not the case. The best ever happens to be John Cleese, Bill Murray, and Fred Willard. So that, you know, but thank you very much, Fred, for that. And, oh, hi, folks. I didn't know you were eavesdropping on that. We won't use that at all in any promotional material for our show, Fred, I can assure you. That's bullshit. And also, no, it was very nice. In fact, I needed that right at that moment. At that particular moment, I needed that because I was going through some, I was on Twitter going through a variety of emotions having to do with career, self-worth, the future of the planet, and like that. So thank you for that, brother. And also this past weekend, I spent time with my ex, Maria. She is, as I've told you, and I will not tire of telling you, she's going through a tough time, man. She's having hip replacement surgery in June. Now, this just happens. I know it sounds like kind of an old person disease, but it's, what are you going to do? I mean, thank God I'm not going through it. I don't know. Probably I will at some point. She was an athlete. She played basketball. Maria was really active, you know, did a lot of hiking and running and vaulting fences and running away from cops. And, you know, of course, I'm kidding about that. Maybe. I don't know. No, but she did. She did a lot of athletic stuff. So this is going to happen. My cousin Fran back in Toronto, she was on a rowing team. She played basketball. She played baseball. She was a wrestler. I'm kidding. She was athletic too, and she's having her knee replaced. Now, the thing that's wrong with me, the one thing I know that's wrong with me, because I've seen the x-rays, is I got a bad neck, and it's caused me everything from headaches to pinched nerves, all kinds of stuff. And I've actually seen the x-rays of my neck, and I'm wondering, do they have neck replacement or head replacement? No, they don't. I doubt seriously whether there's that. I hope that never comes up. And if it does, I hope they have something for Phil. We got to replace your neck. Unfortunately, we don't have anything even approaching that kind of surgery. So good luck and good night. But you know, it's a matter of me just hanging with her. And people are, you know, I've had a lot of people saying the following thing. Oh, you're hanging with your ex, huh? Lovesick? No, not lovesick. I mean, I love her, and she's my friend. She was a part of my life for a significant part of it. And you see somebody like that who's having a problem, man, you want to help them. It's the first instinct you have. I'm not saying you should have it, but it's. I think it's pretty natural is to say, well, what can I do, right? And this kid, she's the thing about her that blows me away, and I know I couldn't do this. She started back to school almost 2 years ago. She was diagnosed with this. She thought she had bursitis, and then she went to the doctor, and they did an MRI, and she realized they had, you know, she was well advanced with this problem and would need hip replacement surgery halfway through that two-year period. So for the last many months, she's been going to school and dealing with the pain of this bloody problem. So yeah, why wouldn't you want to help somebody like that? I mean, I'm pretty impressed with her heading back to school and getting her master's, and eventually she wants to get her doctorate. And I probably have told you this already, but man, it blows me away. I mean, I'm sure you have been surprised by somebody. You know, I didn't know you had that in you. I didn't know that was a part of I have to say, and I told her this last night, so I'm not saying this for the first time. I said, I'm really, I had you all wrong. You know, I told her, I said, I had you all wrong, man. I didn't think you were capable of this. I didn't think you were this tough. And she said to me, well, I am. So, yeah, what are you going to do about make me look like my punk? So that was a nightmare I was having. But seriously, I said to her, you know, I didn't know that you were this tough. And she picked me up and threw me through a window. And I've always felt, no, I really did say that to her, and she was very grateful that I said it. And I meant it. So, getting my eyes open these days, sports fans, I'll tell you that. Lots of stuff like that. Ooh, sorry, I just bumped the mic, as it's spelled, M-I-C, as opposed to M-I-K-E. And also, thanks for the dinner, Maria. It was fantastic. By the way, I looked up hip replacement surgery, and it goes back to 1940. Well, the first one that was attempted, I don't know if it was successful or not, but the first one that of note that has been recorded by history was in 1891, if I'm not mistaken, in Germany. 1891, using steel. Okay? Now, I believe the modern era of hip replacement was around 1940, and this was in South Carolina, believe it or not, at a hospital in South Carolina. And I don't know what the technique was there. It might have been a further refinement, but that might have been the next big step. I only, and I'm sure you guys are the same way, I only heard about this kind of surgery. I guess you hear about it when more and more of your friends start having it done or something, because I didn't hear about this until recently, like within the last 20 years. And I told you what my father-in-law had it done. So now I got my cousin's getting her knee done. Maria's getting her hips done. You know, Carter had his hips done. I've been the Swede. He's off riding horses in Mongolia. So thank God we got it, man. I'll tell you that. I mean, I can't believe that, this is just a matter of being able to have a life. Because if you know anybody that needs that, man, watching them suffer with that is like, it's a drag. So I don't want to belabor the point, but it's been a significant part of my life, you know. I can't wait for her to have this surgery, and then the summer comes and she's back to doing the stuff she wants to do, you know. And it's kind of a no-brainer as far as I'm concerned. I saw a thing here that I wanted to just comment on, and it has to do with playing golf and talking business. Now, this is not a political comment on the President Trump, not at all. It's more about business and golf. Now, a lot of people say, and I had a guy say this to me once in Hawaii. He actually looked across a luau table at me. I was there with my girlfriend, and we were at a luau that the hotel was, you know, sponsoring or putting on. And there was a couple there, and I go, $1 million deals, Phil. $1 million deals are made on the golf course. Now, I've played golf since my early 20s. I did not start in my teens. It was never a passion of mine, but I found out that my friends were playing golf, and it was a great way to hang with them. And they got me into it. Hey, Phil, you want to play golf? It looks kind of tough. Nah, don't give me that. Okay, so, wow, all right, this is kind of fun because I can do this, and it's just another way of losing money. It's just another bet, another series of bets, and another series of ways of dropping a whole lot of cash. So that was great. I really needed that. And started playing golf. Now, maybe it's because I've never been really good at it. I don't think I've ever in my life broken 90 in my life. It's a tough game. It's not a baseball swing. It's a golf swing. Most of us approach the game of golf the way we swing with a baseball bat. We swing with our wrists and our arms. You don't do that with golf. You're doing it from the hips. The whole body is turning. All kinds of stuff's happening there. Completely different. Got to keep the arm straight. The left arm straight if you're, you know, right-handed. And, you know, constantly, don't look up. Don't look up. You look up, you see a bad shot. Keep that left arm straight. Now, you know, you're moving your body. You're like, oh, man. And, you know, that's why I've seen a lot of clubs broken and thrown. I've thrown a few and broken a few myself. it's kind of frustrating. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff you're thinking about, and a lot of time is spent getting the game down. And although it should be automatic, and it should be just a process of playing it, you know, and forgetting it. And I'm sure if I were to talk to guys like Donald Trump, or any guy that feels he's good at it, would say, a long time ago, I stopped doing that, man. I'm as fluid as hell. But here's the thing. I don't know what kind of business you can get done on a golf course. Now, I've been out on golf courses, and I have talked to other players about stuff other than golf. I've talked to them about how's your family. We've told jokes. We've mentioned movies that we've seen. We've talked about, you know, stuff at large. But there's never been any negotiation or discussion, because you're constantly thinking about the game. Now, I'm not saying that it hasn't been done, but I have a stinking suspicion, and I don't think I'm revealing anything too heavy here, but it might very well be that I am opening, a sort of a Pandora's box. I think a lot of these guys that say that they cut million-dollar deals out on the golf course are full of shit. I don't think they actually do that. I think they say that so that they have an excuse to go out onto the golf course, and they get permission from mama to go out and do it, you know. Well, I'm golfing with Bill Headley from Asshole Enterprises, and I've got to go out. We're going to close a deal. You ain't going to close diddly squat. You're going to go out there and golf. The deal you're going to close is what you do after the golf game, when you go back to your office or go to the Denny's down the street, or go to the clubhouse and start parking those gimlets like there's no tomorrow. All right. That's when you're going to do your deal. Or let me put it this way. That's when the guy is going to, you know, do the deal on you as you continue the 19th hole drinking. So, like I say, I could be wrong, but I do suspect that, in other words, it's an excuse to play golf. It's an excuse. It's another way, because the game is an addiction, and it certainly is a passion for people to play it well, and you want to play it a lot. Now you have to figure out a way to go out and play it so that people aren't giving you crap about it. They're not, what are you, golfing again? Well, because, for instance, what if you didn't have the excuse of, where are you going? I'm going to play some golf. How many times, please let me go out. How many times this week are you playing? I don't know. It's 5-6 times today. Go to work, man. Go to work. I just want to play. No. No more golf. What is it with you guys? Then they come up with this. If I tell them that I'm making all these big deals out on the golf course, if I tell them that, you see, I'll get away with it. So, what are you doing? I'm going out, I'm golfing with Bob Headley from Asshole Enterprises, okay? Well, what is that supposed to? It means we're about ready to nail a big deal. You want to eat? I assume you want to eat, right? Well, yeah, okay. You want the kids to eat? Yeah. Well, then let me just go, and thank you very much, honey. Just keep it, you know, mind your own business. I'll go and do this. Okay, honey. And then you get out there, and the only thing you hear these guys talking about is, man, I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to take it to you. You took that 50 off of me last week. Watch what I do to you, man. Watch this shot. All they are giving each other shit for the next 18 holes. And seeing how they can rob each other out there on the putting green, you know, and that's it. And then the business, I suspect, is discussed afterwards. So this is what I think is happening. This is what I think is happening. When you say, I'm going to go out and I'm going to golf, but that other guy was golfing and he shouldn't do that, you're pretty much copping to the fact that you can't do anything other than golf when you're out on the golf course. Obama's doing what he's golfing? Bullshit. He should be back at the White House doing a bit. Now, I'm going to go out there. What are you doing? I'm going to cut deals. So that makes it okay. That makes it okay. That way you can tell people, I'm golfing with a purpose. But I think there's no such thing as going out and cutting a goddamn deal, because I've done it. I've golfed, and I've golfed a lot over the last however many years, 40 years, 40 plus years. And so I've been on a lot of golf courses, and I'm not the best, but I've been, and I've never been able to talk substantially about anything other than chicken shit and golf and the game that you're playing right then and there. Now, if somebody else has done that, I would challenge them to tell me exactly how did you do that between shots? Because any deal you're going to cut on a golf course, it's already pretty well been talked out. The negotiation has been done, and the whatever the hell it is you're going to do is going to be done. And you're just out there, what, putting icing on the cake, you know, dropping a cherry on top of this thing. I tell you, let's go do a round of golf, and we'll hammer out the details on your bonus or something like that. But no real substantial business can be discussed out there. I do not buy that. And I'm not saying that because I've got any particular axe to grind politically. It's got nothing to do with that. It's been in the news a lot, you know. It's been in the news a lot. I mean, this discussion of golf and how much business can you get done when you're golfing? And I'm just telling you right now, my experience, you can't get jack squat done while you're out there golfing. Like I said, other than just tell a few dirty jokes and give some guy crap about his putt or his drive. And hell yeah, how's the family? And then, you know, that kind of stuff. Small talk. Believe me. So I don't golf anymore. And one of the reasons why I don't is because I wrecked my back back in the whenever the hell it was. I think I've told the story a million times, you know, picking a bag up at Burbank. So I don't even go out there anymore. And I can tell you that I'm not missing out on anything in terms of business. That's for damn sure. I'm missing out on a lot of laughs. But I'll tell you, it's a great way to a great way to get a deal done. Horseshit. You talking about? I could get a deal done better taking a guy out for dinner. You can talk business more substantially and probably have a way better time doing it just going out to a steakhouse, going to Ted's of Beverly Hills, you know, and having Ted come by with the thick Tedlet or whatever the hell it is he serves there. You can get more business done that way just hanging out in a restaurant over a meal than you can swinging a golf club. And I just believe that this is, and golf's a great game. Believe me, I love watching it. When's the Masters, by the way? Is that next week? Yeah. I love watching the game. Fantastic. Great, you know, beautiful thing. But don't tell me, man, that these guys are doing anything other than coming up with a line of shit for their wife or whoever, the voting public, when they say, well, we're getting some deals done out there. Because I don't believe that for a minute. That's what my story is. I'm sticking with it. Thank you. All right, so there's that, and I'm very happy to have been able to get that off my chest. Tomorrow night, I'm starting an acting class, and I know, go ahead, laugh. Laugh if you want. It's okay. It's all right. You can laugh. What do you think you're going to do, man? You're 60, how old? You're going to go to an acting class with what? Yeah. 20-year-old people, 30-year-old, they're going to turn around and look at the far-out old man walking in the room. That's me. That's what I'm going to do. That's what I'm going to do. Because as I do these on-camera gigs, however rare they are, I got to know what the hell it is I'm doing. Now, some people say this to me. Most recently, last night, Maria was saying this to me, and a lot of my friends. You don't need that, man. What are you talking about? You've been acting your whole life when you do the characters and the thing and that. Yes, I do. Because it's different, man, from what I've been doing. It's different. It's on camera as opposed to being on a microphone. All that you can handle that. I know maybe I can, but I gotta go and I gotta have a set of things that I know how to, that I need this. I need a set of things to kind of a checklist of things so that I can process this and do it. And I figure it's the next step, man. I never thought, to be honest with you, I never really believed, and I never thought about this, that what I was doing in radio would eventually sort of surpass radio's ability to promote me, program my show. In other words, it went beyond what radio had the capacity to do. I'm not saying that I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread. I ain't even saying that I'm better than anybody, but I'm just saying that what I do is so far outside the realm of radio. For starters, nobody wants to do satire in the radio business. Nobody wants to do a stylized kind of satire in the radio business. Nobody wants to. They don't mind being controversial if the guy's a conservative host or maybe a liberal host and they're talking all this shit about, you know, some other political figure or some other, you know, that's their kind of controversy. Controversy they cannot handle is some weird ass on the radio fucking with their callers. That was never anything they were comfortable with. So what happened was I said, well, I know what I'll do. I got to go digital and I'll just do that. And we will just go into business for ourselves, you know, and we will, the product that I create, we'll sell it. It's the way they're doing it. Everybody else is doing that right now online. We'll do it that way. And then, you know, take a look at what other advantages or what other opportunities there are. And the other opportunities, the only other opportunities for me, besides doing voiceover, is on camera work. As either a comic actor or you know, God willing, you know, the next great Olivier. And so I figure if you're gonna be Larry Olivier, you gotta take an acting class, don't you? I figure that's what you gotta do. Well, I don't know. Yeah. You figure he took one or two, didn't he? I think he probably did. Yeah. Larry Olivier. Huh?
Yeah.
Huh? Oh, yeah. Who's he? You know, the guy. That's who they talk about. Who's a good American actor? Who's the really good American actor? Come on. You know. I know. Daniel Day-Lewis. He ain't American. Yeah, he is. Where's he from? Wisconsin. That's the guy he played in the There's Gonna Be Blood thing. So that's the conversation. And that's kind of me talking to my friends, in other words.
Yeah, I figure I gotta do that, you know.
Then what?
Then I get a bunch of TV gigs. Oh, yeah.
Well, why not, you know? And so tomorrow night I will commence doing that. I did take another class, and it was how to audition. Believe it or not, yeah. And it's a good class because, frankly, you got to know how to audition. It's a whole different thing from... It's actually different from acting. Yeah. You know,
you're a good actor?
Yeah, but I don't know how to I don't know how to get the job, so I did that. So taking this class. And you know, I've already had the experience of walking in there as the old guy, and everybody in the room is like... So I said to the teacher, Robert, who's a great guy, Robert Devonzo, I said, do you have cats my age? He said, man, I got an 80-year-old dude. It's going to be okay. So I'm thinking, oh, great, man. I'll walk in. Nope. But, I mean, I'm sure he's telling me the truth. When I walked in there, it was like nothing but 20 and 30-something. But everybody's cool. And the class, you know, it went on for 6 or 7 weeks. And, you know, and now I know how to do that. Or at least I think I do. So then the next one is this. And this is all a part and part. This is nothing I ever thought that I would be, that I would need to do. And I guess what I'm telling you is, you know, life, man, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know. It isn't so much how you're running your life. It's how the world around you is changing. How the very industry you're in changes. When I was growing up and I was thinking about a career in radio and I was thinking about doing a really highly stylized performance kind of art where I would create, you know, this reality, and I would sort of involve the audience in it in some way. I didn't quite know how I was going to do it. And getting the nerve up to do that, because you got to understand something, man. I started out in Orlando, Florida in 1973. And while I did have a proficiency and sort of an aptitude in doing character voices, I didn't really know how I was going to use them. But I couldn't use them. I didn't want to use them the way guys were using them in those days. And the way guys were using them in those days was... And here's our little friend, Billy. What time is it, Billy?
It's 3:00.
Thank you. You know, or probably in a lot of ways, it's the way I use them now. But then I didn't want to. And besides that, I had too many weird things I wanted to say. That there was no way was it going to pass muster with any program director. So I finally got the guts. And I spent 16 years as a disc jockey trying to awkwardly apply a lot of these things. Couldn't do it because you're living in a world where, and the radio world, believe me, is one in which they have limits and they will not go past those limits. I'm not putting the industry down, but I'm trying to explain, I'm trying to give you a snapshot of the challenges there and the limitations there. And I'm wondering if you know, probably every industry has these, but in the radio business, and a business that should be about entertainment, it really isn't. It's about, it's a platform for commercials is what it is. And I'm being accurate. I'm not trying to be vituperative. I'm not trying to insult. It is really, that's what it is. It's a platform. How do we get more commercials on there? And how do we, and how do we spend as little money as possible doing everything else? And I've often said this, the proof of that is, you know, what was the movie? Moonlight? Moonlight just won an Academy Award. I think it's one of the lowest in terms of making money. Maybe I'm wrong, but it's one of the lowest grossing films in Academy Award history. Hurt Locker, I think, made less. And those two movies won Best Picture of the Year. Now, that would never happen in the world of radio in terms of talent and shows and presentation. They would never, ever, ever give an award, give a Personality of the Year, show it, whatever the hell you want to call it, to anybody that isn't making big, big money for their station, their network, the industry at large, because that's what it's about. It never occurred to me, and I never really got that fully until I got into syndicated radio, because that was about as high as I could, and is, in fact, as high as you can go on the ladder of broadcasting. And again, I'm not finding fault. What I'm saying is these are the lessons that I had to learn. And as you learn these lessons, so this is the environment that I'm in. I'm doing all this kooky shit, and people are telling me it's fucking funny, Phil. I mean, god damn. But I'm not getting anywhere, you know? I'm not, like, we're kind of stuck. And that's when you say, if you've got any brains at all, and I'd like to think I got a few, then you say, oh, okay, well, I realize now what I have to do. I don't think I'm long for this business. It's just not, it's like I'm bumping my head on this this ceiling. It's as high as I can go, you know. And for my show, the kind of show that I did, to make a lot of money, and to, because we were constantly struggling with affiliates, constantly struggling with ratings, constantly struggling for commercial content. It needed a certain kind of support that the business wasn't willing to give it. So now what do? You go into what's the next thing on the horizon? This, the digital world. You own your own product. You can sell it as you want to. You can sell subscriptions as you want to. You pretty much just go direct to the customer. You know, good old-fashioned you know, business, the good old-fashioned business model of sitting there with a lemonade stand. You know, hi, I'm Phil. Oh, you're the guy? Yes. Well, isn't that cute? And what are you doing now? Well, I have these products. See, look, it's cute. That's a website, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's nice. So the website does what? Does it magically?
No, you have to listen to it, but you have to pay a subscription.
Oh, a subscription.
And interestingly enough, as odious as that may sound to some people, having to pay, you know, for content, we are living in an age now where getting subscriptions for entertainment isn't too far. It's not too far out of an idea. Netflix is made out of money. I mean, those dudes are made of money. And the only bread that they have, the only bread that they've got, I think, is subscription money. So, you know, people are willing if it's worth it. And we're constantly trying to improve. Like, for instance, I have a brand new website design. And I think it's more in keeping with what I'm about and what we do. It's a freaking cartoon that we do here, man. And it's a cartoon world. It's just a cartoon world. And we have all of this archival material. And so we needed to organize it. And I think we needed to present it in a way where it said, okay, here is the show, and here's where the other things are, and this is what we do, and welcome, and have fun. So that's what we hope our new website represents. And I know that it's a lot easier to navigate, and I know that it's a lot more intuitive to use.
and so forth. But that's what, you know, I decided to do. Now, where the hell am I going with this? Oh, I know. It all has to do with the hip replacement. That's it. No, I don't. To be honest with you, I don't really have any. There's no destination that I'm necessarily going to arrive at here and telling you the story other than to justify my existence and to ask you to subscribe to our web. No, I'm kidding about that. It's to tell you sort of the process that I went through creatively in my career to get to where I am today. And I just had a conversation with a guy. Oh, I know. It was about Fred Willard, right? Okay. I just had a conversation with a guy. Okay, great. Thank you very much, Fred, but I'm on to something else. Now, I had a conversation with a guy who said just 2 days ago, yeah, Phil, so-and-so, I'm with such-and-such and so-and-so.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That stuff you do. Now, I love this bit you did. Now, what do I got to do? Oh, there's a bit. It's fantastic.
Uh-huh.
But do I got to buy a subscription? Is that it? Well, ordinarily, yeah. But since you're a professional and, you know, we're sort of in the same thing, I can probably, you know. Yeah, I'd appreciate that, huh? Because I don't have to buy a whole subscription, do I?
No. You don't have to do that. It's cool. I'll,
Can you send that to me? Because, Christ, it's the funniest goddamn thing I've ever heard in my life.
Well, it's great. Thank you very much.
But I don't want to pay for it.
So I said to the guy, all right, you cheap creep. No, I didn't. I said, yeah, I'll send it to you.
The other thing that I've stopped doing is I have this show, and it's popular on its own merits, and these characters that I created are popular among people who've listened to the show and maybe some new people. But, okay, I've already done that, man. So I don't think taking all of those characters that I've created or that style of entertainment that I've created and trying to push it out onto television, I don't think, or into a movie, I don't think is what I should be doing. I need to keep on evolving, you know, and keep on creating and trying to find another way of expressing things. So that's why I am always on the move here. I can't, you know, just stand still at resting on those old laurels. So I don't know, you know, whatever comes, but what I do enjoy doing is I damn sure like eating and, you know, and I also like doing, you know, having this freedom to just be in business for myself. It's a weird time. I mean, I come out of a business, out of an industry that really controlled the talent from beginning to end, from sun up to sun down, and they owned everything that you ever created in your life, so don't even think about it, you know, and when they wanted to get rid of you, they got rid of you, and that was it, you know. You're pretty much a gypsy, that's what they called you, you know, you had your U-Haul, and you went from town to town. Now, suddenly, within the last 20 years or so, everybody owns their own material, everyone has their own website, everybody has their own business, and there isn't anything left for those guys to do but become purveyors. You know, they are the people that go out and sell it for you. So they're now essentially a platform that you utilize for commercial sales, but nothing more. You promote and you place your show wherever you want to put it. That's fantastic. It sounds ideal. It's a hell of a lot of work, though. It's a bitch. But you got to learn how to do these things, you know. So, I don't know when it was, maybe about a year ago, I was sitting with some people in Atlanta. It was at a radio conference. They said to me, how do you do this shit? And I said, well, here's what you have to do. You know, first of all, you have to get the rights to your show, the rights to all of your own material. And once you have that, then you're pretty set, man. So you then find whatever platform you want to begin to, you know, maximize that stuff commercially, monetarily, monetize it, as they like to say. And that's going to be, you know, that means you're in business for yourself. And, you know, you're going to make some money, but God almighty, brother, good luck with the overhead, you know, because you're bringing people on to help you do that. And I'm learning this stuff on the run. But, hey, it is what it is. Now, if somebody said to me, would you give that up for a big-time money gig back in radio? Not if I wasn't able to sit down and laugh and be happy, like Sheriff John used to say. No, I wouldn't be. I wouldn't be interested in that. No. You know, I'd rather just do this and See where that goes. And then there's, you know, there's voiceover work and shit like that. Now, I just saw a thing here. Jared Kushner, is China getting him laid? Is that what's going on? No. It was just a thing in the paper. See, you got to do what Bob Watson of the Houston Astros and later of the New York Yankees did to become a major league catcher. You have to learn as much as you can, and you have to be as proficient as you can at as many things as you can. I mean, don't stretch yourself so thin. Don't try and become something that you're not, and don't waste your time developing or trying to develop a skill that you're not interested in, but try to learn as much as you can about what you do. And there was a book out back in the 70s called Ball Four. It was written by Jim Boughton, who was a Major League Baseball pitcher, Major League, you know, pitcher. And Jim Boughton wrote this book, and it's a phenomenal book. It's the first tell-all. It's the first book of its kind. It was the first sports book that laid bare all of the raunchy truth of that world. You know, up until then, all the books were, well, you know, I ate my Wheaties and I hit a bunch of home runs. It was just wonderful. Later, I retired and became a dairy farmer. And it was pretty, you know, all of the books were intended to be very, very positive tales of positive tales that reinforced both the player and the game of baseball in the minds and in the hearts of the fans. That all the fantasies about them being All-American were true. The truth, though, was, of course, different, you know, because we're people. And people are imperfect, and God knows we get into trouble. So Ball Four comes out, written by Jim Boughton, and it has all of those truths. It has the truths of the way players are in the clubhouse, and the way they thought, really, of the manager and the coaches, and what they thought of the owners, and what they did for laughs, and how they alleviated the boredom, and what and how cheap these teams were, and what a pain in the ass it was to get older in the game. All of this stuff that Boughton wrote about. He was a member of the New York Yankees. He pitched in a World Series. I don't know how many games he pitched in, but Jim Boughton actually made it to the level of playing in a World Series. One of the things he said that I'll never forget, he said, if I took all of the advice from all of the pitching coaches that I ever had, if I took all that advice and I put it all together, I never would have pitched in a World Series. Basically, he's saying, all of this advice, I get, some of it conflicts. Some of it doesn't make any sense. Some of it's coming right out of some guy's ass. You know, I have to, it's ultimately up to you to figure out what works, right? So there he is, and I don't know what team he was on. He's in the later stages of his career, and Jim Boughton gets the idea that he can extend his career as a pitcher, if he learns how to throw the knuckleball. Now, a knuckleball, and I don't have a lot of working knowledge of pitching, but a knuckleball is thrown in such a way, you're first of all putting your fingertips on the ball, and when you release it, the ball has an extreme drop at the plate. It looks like it's heading for the strike zone, and then all of a sudden, like it fell off a cliff, just boom. And can be an effective pitch. There's a problem with it, though. No catcher wants to go anywhere near a knuckleball. It's a tough pitch to catch. But this is what Boughton has decided he can use to continue to be a good pitcher, to continue his effectiveness. Now, along comes, you know, so he's on these teams, and he wants to warm up, or he wants to practice his pitching. First thing he's got to do is, any of you guys want to, you know, goes to the catchers, which major league roster carries, what, four, maybe three, three or four, maybe two, I don't know. There's four guys. Anybody want to catch me? It's that knuckleball? Forget it. You know, nobody wants to go near it. You guys want to catch me? I'm going to try and catch what? The knuckleball? Oh, yeah, sure. What do you mean catch it? Nobody catches that thing. You're chasing it is what you do with the knuckleball, you know. So, or you're trapping it. That's the guys that catch knuckleballs generally could just trap it like it's a damn, like it's a rat that got out of a cage or something. Now, along comes this kid, Bob Watson. A lot of you guys may remember him. He went on to become a pretty decent baseball player. And Bob Watson was a catcher. And he didn't have that attitude that the other catchers had. He looked at Boughton as a way to improve himself as a catcher and to gain an additional skill that no other catcher had, and that was how to catch a damn knuckleball. Now, it may not be a skill that much in demand, but it's just one more thing those guys can't do that he wanted to learn how to do. And he would say to Boughton, hey, I'll catch that knuckleball. Yeah, lay that knuckleball on me, man. I'll catch that thing. So he wound up, you know, being Boughton's go-to guy for the knuckleball. And, the moral of the story being, man, if there's some other cats can't do that I can do, I'll do it, you know. And I'll tell you this, and this is the thing that, you know, Robert told me when I was taking that class from him. I said, I don't know, man, you know, I want to enjoy my life, and I want to do this thing, because it seems like this is where I'm supposed to go now, man, because I never really thought my radio career would suddenly, like I ran out of room, you know, I ran out of track. I outpaced, and I don't mean this egotistically, but I got to tell you honestly, I outpaced my own industry. I ran right through the wall, man. I went off the track out into the street. So he says to me, I said, so I don't know. He goes, look at it this way, Phil. You're a new face for your age group. He says, you're a new face. They need a guy, you know, your age. They ain't seen your ass before. He said, a new face. You know what I mean. So I go back to the Bob Watson story. That's something I can do that nobody else is doing. And I'm not saying the other guys are lazy. Don't get me wrong. But I'm wondering how many new faces there are out there for television or film or whatever, commercials, that are 64 years old. So I got to take the Bob Watson approach. Yeah, man, lay that on me. What do you got? I'll tell you what I got. I'm 64. You ain't ever seen my ass before. Let's go. What do you got? Huh? What do you got? So that's how I'm thinking of it. And I remind myself of my old man when I do that. I automatically, all of a sudden, I go, God damn it, that's the way my father was. I'm not saying my dad was any great success. He was not, well, at certain points of his life he was. But by the time my father, you know, by the time he was done with this whole thing called life, you know, he'd screwed up a lot. He had screwed up a lot. But God, if that dude didn't try everything under the sun, by the time my father passed from this earth, he had gone from being a salesman selling business machines to selling, I swear to God, he got into the ground floor of computers. He actually went back to school in his early 50s to learn about computers. He took a course that the company he was working for gave so that he could begin to have some functioning understanding of computers. This was in the late 60s. He went to Europe and started selling business machines for, of all companies, Singer, the sewing machine company. They branched out. They went beyond sewing machines, and they started to get into business machines. And then I think Sony bought them. And he came back to the States, and as his career as a salesman in the corporate world was winding out, he got another bright idea. He says to my sister, why don't we fly these packages to San Francisco over, you know, we'll get it up there in one hour, 2 hours for these people. Right? You know what I'm talking about now. It's called Federal Express. This was before Federal Express, I'm here to tell you. My sister and my father went into business, and they would run packages between LA and San Francisco for different businesses, charge them a certain amount of money and take the packages back and forth. But they never really busted out of that idea. They never really expanded the idea. I guess you need some seed capital, obviously. And the other thing I don't think they got was the whole idea of insurance. You know, you have to insure. So the overhead on this stuff, if you're really going to get serious, is significant. It's not it doesn't have to break the bank, but you got to think about certain things. And when I came upon this little business that they had, I was in my, I don't know, mid to late 20s. And my father said, yeah, you know, Joanne and I were running this business between San Francisco and LA. I said, what are you doing? He said, we're sending up packages, you know, mailing, we're flying packages up there. You like overnight? No, not overnight. Same damn day. No kidding. Yeah. You know, you want in? You know how salespeople are. Well, this is my father. You want in? Because if you want in, you better get in now.
I'm telling you right now, Philip. Because I'm telling you right now, this thing is, you know, it's going to be well beyond my ability to bring you. So I got really interested in this, and then I was the one that brought up to him, what about insurance, Dad? What? I said, are these things insured? What do you do if you lose one? What if the plane crashes? You know, that night I got a message from him. I've told Joanne, we stopped the business cold right today until we figure this insurance thing out. Which they could have done, but I don't know. You know, they didn't do it. Right? Here's the next idea he had. This is why he never stopped thinking, this guy. I got to hand it to my father. But the problem with him was that he didn't push it all the way to its penultimate point, you know, to where it really became a million-dollar idea. The other idea he had, he goes out and he buys a coach, a mini bus. I don't know what the hell it was. I saw it once, and it looked pretty damn good. And his idea was the following. We're going to take executives. Look at this. My cat's here. Hey, Thunder, take a chill, man. The idea was to take executives between airports and hotels, between hotel and hotel, from their home to the airport. In other words, it would be an executive coach. This is, again, at a point in our history, I think the 70s, when you either ordered a car, a personal car for yourself, you took a cab, you had a limousine, or you drove your own damn car, you know. But no one ever had come up with this idea of a luxury coach. And I'm not talking about, you know, the shuttle, that you know, 12 buck shuttle that runs your ass between the airport and wherever you're going. I'm talking about a luxury coach with, I don't know how many, maybe 10 seats, with the Wall Street Journal, and it's got coffee and the whole damn thing. He buys this thing. I go over to his house one day, and there it is sitting on the driveway, and he and his wife, my stepmother Ruth, are in there refurbishing this thing, reupholstering. I said, what is this, Dad? Oh, this is beautiful. See, what you do is you drive executives. Now, he knew this because he was in that world for how many years? It's like my father was thinking, okay, based upon my experience, what did that world of the traveling executive salesman businessman need? And there they were creating this thing. And it was only within a few short years after that that the world of the executive business coach really came into its own. And now, you know, you can take these, they got all kinds of ways, man. They got self-driving, damn, forget it, you know. So the business coach thing took off. They got business coaches now, man, that drive themselves, you know. They have individual mini business coaches, little pods that take off and fly you to the airport. Who knows? What happened there was my father got sick. He had an aneurysm, if you're ready for that, and survived it. I said, what the hell? He says, yeah. I said, I didn't know who I was, man. He said, I didn't know whether I was coming or going. He said, it took me months to figure out who the hell I, you know, where I was, who I was, what the hell. He said it was crazy, you know. Now, my old man eventually, I'm not trying to tell a big, long, sad story because I honor him and respect him, but he was also a real screw up as a parent. And I would also say, proffer this. He was a real screw up as a man, but he never quit pitching, man, you know. And the unfortunate thing about my dad was that he got very sick. He had an Alzheimer's like condition toward the end of his life, and then that was the end of that. He was off into the wild blue yonder. But that's a cat that I gotta say, that dude kept pushing out, and these ideas that he had were just one step ahead, two steps, three steps ahead of the rest of the pack, but he couldn't, you know what it is, man? He could not clinch the idea, turn it into the $1 million that it should be. Now, Thunder, what do you want? Hey, Thunder. I got my cat is screaming and crying and belly aching about something. So learn how to catch the knuckleball. There you go. That is today's lesson. Learn how to catch that knuckleball, and you will never, ever be without
the ability to catch a knuckleball. You will. There's going to be somebody who's going to need that. You know? So when I said to the radio world back in 2013, 2012, goodbye, because I'd had it, man. I really, the last cat that I worked for, that was the end for me. I knew that, I already knew I could make a living, because that's, we were doing that, man. We were making money online. So I said, well, I already knew that we were making money over there. It's not that big of a thing. We'll just stop doing radio. And we did. And one thing my old man never did is he never said, Marge, which is my mom's name, I'm going to go play a round of golf with,
why is that?
Because I'm going to close this deal like a son of a bitch. No. If I'd asked my old man, where did you generally close all of your deals? Probably having lunch or having a drink or who knows, you know? He told a story, and I tell this story now because, I don't know, for some reason it applies to situations more now than ever before, because I'm always talking to people about business. And my old man was in Eastern Europe, and he was selling some business machines to a government agency in Eastern Europe. I don't know whether it was a town or whether it was a county or a state or whatever it was. It was a communist country. This was in a period of time when the Iron Curtain was still up. But there was limited business going on in Europe between the so-called Western countries, the democracies, and these socialist states of Eastern Europe. And he was in one of them, and he sold them a bunch of business machines. And they come back to him, and they say, he says, well, here's the amount that they're worth. He said, will you take hides? Hides, H-I-D-E-S, animal hides. So this is a government. I'm not talking about a farmer. I'm talking about a government that wants to transact business, barter business with animal hides. And my father goes back to his hotel. He gets on the phone with his company, and he said, I did this deal for these machines with this thing, but they want to do the business. They want to transact it with hides. They want to pay with hides. So the company goes, you know, into their, you know, computers, or they go to their calculators, and they go and take a look at what the market, you know, because there's a place where all this crap, all these commodities get traded, obviously. They come back on the phone, and they say, yeah, do it. It's worth it, you know. Now that I don't know about, man, but I did talk to my very good friend and a great football coach and a great man, Bill Riddell, who coached at Oaks Christian High School here in Southern California and was a former Canadian Football League player as well as a star player at Occidental College. And he's the guy upon whom Coach Vernon Dozier is based. And Bill told me that when he played in Canada, he said, what was it like playing football in Canada? He said, well, you know, he said, in the big cities, Toronto, Montreal, it was like playing in the States. You know, you go to these big stadiums and the fans. He said, but out in the prairie lands, you know, I was like, what do you mean? Out like Saskatchewan. It was a little different because the people out there, they're farmers, and they purchased their season tickets with wheat. I said bullshit, because my foot. No, I'm not kidding you. Wheat. So there's more than one way to get a Saskatchewan Rough Rider season ticket, if you pardon the expression, Rough Rider, and that's with wheat. Okay? So let that be a lesson. I am finished, man. That's it for today's Phil Only. Thank you very much. We'll be back with the regular panel tomorrow. So until such time as we do that, have a great day, and don't forget to go to our website, philhenryshow.com, and get a backstage pass now, man. The newly redesigned Phil Henry Show website, up and running and cranking and everything like that. So get a backstage pass for a month or for a year. The price is going to be going up. Oh, yeah. You know, it has to. So now this is some guitar playing. Famous Phil Henry Show is executive produced by me, Phil Henry, for Siempre Incorporated. All rights reserved on Podcast One.